Hello, friends. I'm Matt Baum, and welcome to the Sewers of Paris. We're on a search for entertainment that changed the lives of gay men. Join me on tonight's episode when my guest Joe says...
The senator, the Senate leader that hired me. So I think the headline was something like, Senator McElhaney brings gay cloud over the Senate office, or something like that.
The topic is Harold and Maude, The Conformist, and Threesome. Do you ever find yourself engaging in self-sabotage? Maybe you avoid important work or important people, or you dismiss your potential, or you lie about yourself to yourself, or you surround yourself with folks who undermine you. My guest this week spent years working for Republicans, wavering in and out of the closet. Inside, he knew who he was, but he also desperately wanted to be accepted and to belong, even among people who might reject him if they know the truth. Eventually, Joe managed to shed those secrets, the sabotage, the self-medication that could have easily turned fatal. Now he's feeling a lot more free, and he works for nonprofits that expand freedoms instead of restrict them. It's Joe's way of hopefully sparing others the pain he went through, and also working through his lingering guilt. By the way, your support makes it possible for me to bring you these stories and clips each week, so if you like what you hear, join supporters like Chris S. by heading over to sewersofparis.com and clicking Support the Show on Patreon. Now here's Joe. Hello and welcome to the Sewers of Paris. I'm joined by political insider Joe Megacy. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
What is the entertainment that changed your life?
There's a movie from 1970 called The Conformist, an Italian movie.
Okay.
Directed by Bernardo Bertolucci.
And what is it about?
It's about a political operative in 1930s Italy and France. And it's about the rise of fascism. And it's sort of this cycle, look into the psychology of fascism, what goes into, you know, attracting certain people to different political ideologies, I guess.
The enchained prisoners of Plato.
And how they resemble us.
And what do they see, the prisoners?
What do they see?
You who come from Italy should know from experience.
They see only the shadows the fire makes on the back of the cavern that faces them.
Shadows, the reflections of things, like what's happening to you people now in Italy.
Say those prisoners were at liberty and could speak out. Mightn't they call the shadows they see reality, not visions?
Yes, yes, correct. They would mistake for reality the shadows of reality. The myth of the great cave. That was the graduate thesis you proposed to do for me. Did you finish it afterwards?
You departed. I used a different theme.
I'm truly sorry, Clerici. I had so much faith in you.
When did you see it?
I first saw it when I was in college. Okay. So this would have been in early 2000s.
Okay. Were you studying politics?
I was studying politics as a political science major.
Okay. And were you, like, so what did it do for you? Did you identify with the character? You're like, oh, this is a cautionary tale.
Not quite then, because I was still in the closet then, and mm-hmm. I was just getting involved, doing more volunteering for college Republicans and various, you know, Republican races here in Colorado. So I was still in the closet then, and I certainly don't think I fully understood what the conformist was all about when I first saw it when I was probably 20 or 21. Mm-hmm. But I think I looked at it as sort of this cool, stylish, you know, 1970s mm-hmm. European thriller. Looked cool. You know, I loved. The Godfather. I'd love The Godfather forever. Mm-hmm. And I saw a lot of like the same sort of stylistic elements then, and I was drawn to it then.
I believe in America. America has made my fortune. And I raised my daughter in the American fashion. I gave her freedom, but I taught her never to dishonor her family. She found a boyfriend, not an Italian. She went to the movies with him. She stayed out late. I didn't protest. 2 months ago, he took her for a drive with another boyfriend. They made her drink whiskey. And then they tried to take advantage of her. She resisted. She kept her honor. So they beat her like an animal. When I went to the hospital, her nose was broken. Her jaw was shattered, held together by wire. She couldn't even weep because of the pain. But I wept. Why did I weep? She was the light of my life. Beautiful girl. Now she will never be beautiful again.
is a stylish guy, and like, I don't know, maybe I was in the closet and I liked all that too. These very cool costumes and this cool architecture. But, you know, it wasn't until I revisited it again after it came out of the closet a few years later. I probably watched it again when I was 23 or 24. And I was dating a guy who was a film studies major, and so we would just, you know, binge watch weird artistic movies and, you know, art films and foreign movies and that sort of thing. And I brought up The Conformist again because I thought it was cool. And then that's when I think I first viewed it, was sort of through a gay lens, and realized that it really is kind of a story about repressed homosexuality.
So, wow, that's fascinating. So, you know, while you were sort of repressing it yourself, like, you just didn't see that.
I know, I didn't see.
But you identified with the character.
I did. Yeah, I still didn't identify with the character, but I didn't see it. I think he was like a tortured kind of guy throughout the whole picture. Like, it doesn't end. He doesn't end in a happy place. He does all these despicable things. And I was sort of a tortured person in my 20s, going through college. You know, college was not exactly the best time for me. I was struggling with a lot of things, and maybe I related with it that I liked dark things back then. But yeah.
You said that it was that you kind of tortured yourself. Was it the closet? Was it you were having confronting that?
Yeah.
Were you raised in an environment where, like, you just couldn't be gay?
Yeah, most definitely. I was raised in a very conservative Catholic family. And European too, so there's a whole sort of set of, you know, old world values that comes along with that as well. So, I mean, is that, and I do think, you know, I think some people, you know, with your political makeup, or like your own personal beliefs, I do think a lot of that is innate. And whether if you're born with it or whatever, I'm not sure that most people have a lot of control over that, honestly, or choice at certainly that age. And so I think I was struggling with that because I was, you know, I was personally, I was conservative, and I was more conservative than I am now, for sure, for certain. And I think that was also a struggle for me.
Sure.
I was angry. I had this conception, you know, when I was 18 or whatever, that I was going to have this, you know, perfect life with a wife and a couple kids and, you know, mortgage and dog and all that. And when I first began to start to realize that I was gay, I was like, honestly, one of my first strong emotions was anger. I was mad that I was like, I felt like the American dream was being like taken away from me because I wasn't able to have that because I was gay.
Who are you mad at?
I don't know. I was mad at the world, I guess.
Okay.
Whoever made me gay. I don't know.
What was the conservative stuff that you were doing when you were young? Like, did you volunteer? Or?
Volunteering, yeah. Mostly volunteering.
Okay.
I was also raised in a political family.
Okay.
Yeah. So I've been around it forever.
Okay. Been in the works. When did you realize that you might be gay?
When I, like, consciously started to realize it? In my early 20s.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you'd been in college for a while?
Yeah. I didn't come out of the closet until I was out of college. And it was sort of the tail end that I started to deal with it.
Did you, when you were watching The Conformist, did you think, so I'm not too familiar with the movie, is the guy the conformist, or is the conformist like someone around him?
No, he's the guy, the main character is the conformist.
Okay. Were you like, I am the conformist?
At that point I was, yeah. When I revisited it again after I came out of the closet and I was, you know, dating that guy who was a film major. Yeah, we talked about that, and he's like, oh my God, he's like, that's like you.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to miss. Like, he's political, and what is he trying to conform to in the movie?
He's trying to be part of, like, the high society, and that's why he, in Italy, he joins the fascists, and he joins Mussolini's fascists, and it's his trajectory. It starts with him in the beginning, joining them, and his sort of explanations for that, and then it ends, you know, the movie ends with Mussolini being toppled and he being very nervous for where he is. He like strove so hard to be part of this society, you know, this fascism, you know, and with the whole idea of that fascism is what, like this a greater man, like this Übermensch, right? And he was, that's what he was attracted to. And I definitely related to that. When I was in high school, I pushed myself hard to be part of this sort of bro culture. And I was. Because I wanted to be accepted. Like, I wanted to be part of something like that. And that's where I gravitated to that for whatever reason, that bro culture.
Sure.
And I was very, the first part of my high school, I was very lonely. Like, I didn't do anything my freshman year. I stayed home, watched weird movies all the time, and I was lonely. And then I decided I didn't want that anymore. It was so bad and so painful that I adopted this sort of fratty, Abercrombie bro culture.
Okay. I was going to ask, like, what did it look like?
Yeah.
I think,
well, yeah, polos and Abercrombie and Fitch and that sort of thing. Yeah, yeah.
Did you do sports?
I did sports. Yeah, I played rugby. Mm-hmm. And I played lacrosse. And I swam.
And you didn't even, like, at that time, you weren't like, oh, but I'm deeply closeted. But
no. Just... So I went to an all-boys high school. Mm. So there was, like, not a ton of pressure for me to...
To date
girls or talk to girls.
Interesting.
And, like I don't know, boys high school, everyone's going through puberty at the same time. Like, to be honest, there's, like, a lot of gay shit that went on.
Sure.
So, like, yeah. Like, I kind of, that part of me was, like, satiated.
Mm.
And then it wasn't until college where that sort of all started to fall apart.
Like, oh, but this is the thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. In another episode, I talked to this guy, Torque, who grew up in the UK and had a similar experience. He was going to a boys' school, and it's like, and so you didn't need to be gay to have gay sex.
Yeah.
So you just could.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it just happened. And I thought everything was fine. I was actually very, like, happy through most of the high school. I'm well adjusted and everything. It wasn't really all that dark because I was, like, fine.
Yeah, exactly.
But then I went to college. That's sort of when it all went to...
So what did that look like? How did you start to realize that you were, like, where was that, when did that awakening happen?
Shortly after college, actually. I had just graduated, and I had developed this relationship with this girl, and I was falling in love with her, basically, I think. And I am in love with her. She's my best friend. She's the one who lives in San Francisco.
Okay.
And I realized then, like, that was compound with that, and then I got in this horrible accident, car accident. I got in a horrible DUI, because obviously I was, abusing substances at the time, trying to, like, cope, I guess. And I got this terrible car accident. I realized, with my friend, that things were, like, progressing in a way, that maybe we were having feelings for each other that were more than just friends. And that just led to this whole, greater reevaluation of my life. And, like, where I was, and that's when I started coming out of the closet.
It sounds like you kind of confronted with this choice of, like, I can try to keep dealing with this, repressing it by, abusing substances and avoid.
Yeah.
Or, that's when the pressure, like, everything that's keeping you in is like, well, maybe it's worth it to come out instead.
Yeah, exactly.
So the friend that you were having feelings for, was that... A guy friend that you were having to... Or were,
no, that was a girl.
Girl. Okay,
a girl.
Yeah.
That was a girl.
So you're like, well, okay, we've got this relationship going, but maybe we shouldn't.
Yeah.
What kind of...
And then I was also sort of... I had a thrush affairs on a mutual friend of ours. Like, this guy, a guy.
Okay.
Yeah, who introduced us, basically.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I was like, this is all messed up.
It sounds like a bit like... Do you know the movie Threesome?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it sounds like that, where, what am I? Who are my alliances with?
Oh, that's funny. That movie, that's definitely... I'm looking back on it. That's definitely one of the first movies I think I was exposed to, like, any sort of gayness, same sex. I remember watching that on cable or something in the mid-90s when I was a preteen or early teen. That's funny.
I've been looking for you.
You have?
We need to talk.
We do?
Why are you backing away from me?
I'm not backing away from you. I'm just walking backwards while you're walking forwards.
I forgive you for telling Stuart about what happened in the library. And I apologize for my exuberance. I don't apologize for my exuberance. I revel in it. And I want to know what this story is with you. Why are you so standoffish with me? Why would you kiss me? Why?
Look, you see, it's...
What?
Oh, never mind.
What?
I can't tell you.
Tell me.
And it's been so long since I've seen it. Yeah. It's a Baldwin, but kind of a lesser Baldwin.
Yeah, like Stephen Baldwin or Daniel Baldwin.
I think
right?
That's right.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it's set in college, and there's a gay guy and a straight girl and a bisexual guy, and the three of them all want each other in different ways.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. So,
and it's like that whole Rules of Attraction too.
Mm-hmm.
Brady Sinalis. That was definitely another formative book I read in college about.
Is that how you started learning, like, what gay could be?
Yes. Yeah, most definitely.
So I must have, like, with your upbringing, must have seemed like, I don't know, okay, this just isn't an option. But what did gay seem like? Like, when you were angry about it, what did it seem like?
It seemed like this sort of, like, deviant, I don't know, subculture? I don't even know. Something so foreign to me. Just something, like, wrong. Yeah.
When did that start to
Which change? Is weird, because I was always sort of a rule breaker, like a troublemaker. I liked it. I liked breaking the rules and getting in trouble and sort of thing. But I don't know why that being gay was just so beyond.
As broken rules go, that's something that would have really changed your life, as opposed to just like, well, I'm going to drink underage.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I think that's what it is. It's such a bigger life-changing thing. Mm-hmm. And like my world then was very like conservative, sort of center-right male, mm-hmm. you know, white male world.
Well, I was going to ask, like, how would you describe yourself at that time? It sounds like, I mean, you're painting a pretty familiar picture. Like, yeah, I think everyone knows, like, that's what that guy is.
Yeah, I'm sure everyone knows. It's pretty stereotypical.
Yeah. So what kind of, like, when you started looking at, like, but I might actually be gay, how did you explore what that is?
I don't know. The internet, I guess, was part of it. I don't know, my girlfriends around me at the time, I think they were very understanding about it all.
Oh, really? How did you come out?
We all went out. No, we went out, and we were coming home in a taxi. Mm-hmm. I don't know why we started talking about something in a taxi that precipitated that conversation. We started talking about it, and the three of us went back in my house, and we had some drinks, for sure. We had been drinking. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't know, it just sort of came out.
I definitely told all my girlfriends first, and then sort of that core group of those, you know, straight white male bro friends of mine second, which was actually, I will say, all of my friends were very supportive, everyone. And, like, understanding.
Oh, that's great.
And sort of like, duh.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So despite all the, like, frat bro...
Yeah, I think they all knew. I know, I thought I was fooling everybody.
You're not as good a conformist as you thought.
Yeah, no. Which makes, I mean, maybe he's not a fool. Because, you know, he's gay. I mean, he has some gay tendencies. That
the character.
For sure. And he thinks he's fooling everybody. Huh. Maybe he's not either.
Interesting. Wow. So did you start dating right away, or how did you explore?
Yeah, I started dating right away.
Okay.
Yeah. I would go, go to the gay bar. I'd bring my girlfriends. I'd make them go with me to the gay bar.
Oh.
And eventually I met somebody. I met the film student, and we were together for a few years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What kind of gay man were you? Were you still kind of, did you have like that bro-y sort of?
Yeah, a little bit. There's always been like, the Colorado bro is sort of a typical specific thing. So there's always a little bit of like hippie hipster in the bro too. So I guess I just sort of started gravitating a little bit more to that, I guess.
Do you feel like something had been lifted from you, like a weight had been lifted?
Yes. Yeah, most definitely. There was like a marked difference in my personality and moods. Like everyone knew it. Everyone could tell. Everyone around me said, it's like the new Joe.
Oh, wow.
You know, it's calmer, nicer.
I guess, you know, it'll do that. And did you stop? Were you drinking or?
Yeah. Drastically cut down all that. Mm-hmm. Drugs.
I was definitely using it to cope. And a lot of that ended.
What kind of work were you doing? Were you still, like, doing conservative political stuff?
Yeah, that's what I've always done. That's all I had done. When I graduated, I was working
as, like, a super volunteer on a Senate campaign here in Colorado. For Pete Coors, the beer guy. Mm. And then after that, I moved overseas, actually, for a couple of years. And lived in Budapest, Hungary, working on a nationwide campaign.
Okay.
For a center-right party there. It's the party there. It's the currently in power. Which is interesting, too. Being fairly freshly out of the closet and living in Budapest. And maybe, you know, a country that's not quite as opening to gay culture as the United States.
You didn't feel any pressure to, like, re-closet while you were there?
I was cautious around work. Mm-hmm. Being working as a conservative Hungarian, it's a sort of a different definition of conservatism over there. Very different than, you know, sort of what we have here, our American spectrum. You know, they're about a big government and everything, but they are very socially conservative, is sort of what the right-wing party is there. So basically everything I'm not. Mm-hmm. All the reasons I'm not. So I was cautious around work, but other than that, socially, no, I was not. Closeted. And actually, there were some steps there, like getting involved in gay culture and things, or doing things in gay culture that I did for the first time there.
Like what?
Like just big gay parties, like circuit parties and stuff.
Okay.
Yeah, like gay nightlife.
What are Hungarian circuit parties like?
They were fun. They were great. Pure party. I don't even know if they still have them. But they would change locations every time, and they would be in these like abandoned warehouses or like apartment buildings, and they would sort of just have a pop-up, and there would be all these multiple levels and different music. They were fun.
Did you feel like there was like just this vast world like unfolding before you? Like there's so much to explore here.
Yeah, there's so much. But also, I guess, I don't know if it was a backlash from trying to conform for all those years, or I've always sort of been a little bit independent and doing my own thing. I really loved when I could find the events and things that were like straight and gay mixed. Mm-hmm. Those were my favorite.
Like what?
Like, there are different, like, parties.
Okay.
Like, we would have one in here, and it still goes on, but it's not quite the same, but called Lip Gloss in Denver. When I came back, we'd go to that every Friday night, and they would take over the salsa club, and it was just a very, like, gay, straight mix. I don't think you'll see it again. It's still around, but it's not the same.
Did you feel any sort of conflict? Because it sounds like you were probably working around a lot of people who weren't where you were on gay stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel like you were in conflict with your coworkers or like just the people in your political sphere?
Yeah. So then when I came back from Europe and I was working, I got a job working for the Republicans at the state legislature doing their communications. I was very cautious and, you know, guarded about things. But then I got outed on a blog.
Really?
On a right-wing blog. So I got outed by our own folks.
So it was someone like, how could this gay person be working for us?
Yeah, it's the senator, the Senate leader that hired me. So I think that headline was something like, Senator McElhaney brings gay cloud over the Senate office or something like that.
Wow.
Yeah, it was pretty ridiculous. And so then after that point, then I started just kind of fighting with pushing back on all the lawmakers to get them to change.
And then, yeah, Colorado's, for its reputation as being progressive, and we have done a lot of great progressive things like legalizing marijuana, and we're ahead on gay rights. It's still a very conservative state. And so, you know, the lawmakers I worked for were very, very conservative folks. You know, this is how I'm focused on the family. And all the leadership I worked for were from Colorado Springs, where the sort of hotbed of social conservatism is in the state. And so I would push a lot of those guys after that point, after getting outed, and it was a lot of fighting. But what was always so interesting to me working there, and I worked in the U.S. Capitol and the Republican congressional office for a while, is that the staff, who are all young, politics is a young people's business, the staff was overwhelmingly always supportive. And it was always sort of the older white men, and the women often didn't get. Like, I was very close with a lot of the female lawmakers, Republican lawmakers. It was always the old white men.
So the person who outed you, what were they expecting? Did they want you to be fired or like?
I don't know. It's an anonymous blog.
Jeez.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. I still don't know. I have like a short list of folks I think it is.
Really?
Yeah.
I love that you still have the list.
But I don't know who it is. I never,
Did the lawmakers that you were working for, did you hear from them like, oh, this is going to be a problem or we don't care?
I mean, I basically answered to one guy, the leader, the Senate minority leader, and he said, it's fine. He's like, I don't care. He's like, are you okay? And he's like, it's fine.
You know, I interviewed, you know, Fred Karger, he ran for president. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. So Fred was a Republican, first Republican, openly gay Republican to run for president. And he had this experience in the 70s when he was working for, I forget who, he was working for a politician in California. He had donated money to the campaign to stop the Briggs Initiative. And he was terrified. It was like $200, which was not a huge contribution, but he was on the list of contributors. And someone did exactly the same thing. They sent a letter to his employer saying, how can you have this homosexual sympathizer working for you? And, I mean, back then, 77, it could be the end of a person's career. And he was very fortunate that the guy he was working for said, this doesn't change anything. I just want you to know that you have enemies out there and you need to be careful.
Yeah. And,
I mean, yikes. Like, same thing, working in the belly of the beast there.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Did you feel like you could affect change from the inside?
Then, when I was actually there, it was awful. It was like banging my head against the wall when I was actually serving in that position. And like I would talk to people and like try to change them from within. And like it felt like I was getting nowhere always. And that the folks that were in positions of power were oblivious to anything I was saying. Mm. Like they just weren't going to change. They're set in their ways. And so it was really frustrating. And I actually left. I didn't do anything in politics the whole year of 2010 because I was just so over everything. But then it's all been really, really satisfying to come back and have those connections and have the skills to be able to talk to those kinds of people. Because then I was able to do some change and I helped organize Republicans when we were considering civil union legislation here. We created this group called Coloradans for Freedom. And I think it was fairly influential on the debate about civil unions.
Yeah, so what brought you back to politics?
I just sort of got recruited back to doing working in a congressional office. And I'd never done federal level stuff. And so I said, okay, I'll do one more. I'll give it one more go. You know, sort of that year I took off, I was just freelancing and, you know, maybe not making a great go of it. And so they brought Bobby back on. And I thought I was interested to get a little federal experience. the congressman that wanted me to come work for him was a big military person. I thought that'd be interesting to get him to talk about military policy and international stuff. Given my background in international work, I was interested in returning to that. So I did that, which was really good. And I was actually glad to do it. And it was tough to work for him. He was a Marine, and the Marines are very particular about what they want.
I'm sure
it's not what they really want you to conform. They want you to do it his way. The military is interesting.
And I had never... That's his number one issue. That's what he's most personally passionate about, Mike Kaufman. And I'd never really been exposed to military culture at all. But it's fascinating. A number of former military, current military in his office. And I was cautious then at work, too. I was never, someone asked me if I was gay, obviously, but I would never bring it up or whatever. It just wasn't germane to me. I'm just a naturally private person. And so I was wondering, it was funny, with some of these military guys, former Marines or current Marines, I was nervous about how they would react. And when I left, we sort of talked with some of them. And there I reconnected with one of them and told him what I was doing now and that I was working for a gay rights organization and was working on marijuana legalization issues. And he was like thrilled and so supportive. Again, you never know. You think some people, a certain culture or background are going to be anti or anything like that, and they're not. But it's interesting. That military culture is certainly one that, it's one that
pushes for conformity. I think, that's what it's all about, right? The uniform, the haircuts, it's all about conformity is a big part of that culture. And fascism, of course, like in the movie, the military aspects of it are huge. It's
all there. Architecture plays a big role in the movie, and all the architecture is very much very militaristic, and a lot of their costumes look very militaristic, even though they're just suits and that sort of thing. And it's wartime, it's the middle of World War II or right before World War II. And so it's interesting, that sort of culture and what it can demand of you.
Was there other entertainment that felt like it was maybe not taking the place, but giving you a different perspective on that kind of thing?
Yeah, there's another movie too. Harold and Maude was a big movie. That was important to me then, because that was actually in the past. I was sort of by the time I was working there in the congressional office and everything, I was way more well adjusted in that respect. But when I was still sort of first coming out of the closet, I remember watching Harold and Maude.
I have a deep love of Harold and Maude. So describe what that movie is.
Harold and Maude is this movie. It was made in 1972, I believe, by Hal Ashby. It was a movie about this unhappy boy who's a teenager, and he falls in love with an octogenarian, that's an 8-year-old woman. And they have this very quirky romance, and this movie is about how they fall in love.
What is it about those two characters? Why do they draw it? Are they drawn to each other?
Well, because when I was struggling with coming out of the closet, when I was dealing with those anger issues of being angry about not having my perfect American life, I was angry because I was like, that's the in my mind, the only kind of love was up between a man and a woman, traditional, quote unquote. And when I saw that movie, I realized that love comes in so many different forms.
I should like to change into a sunflower, most of all. They're so tall and simple. What flower would you like to be?
I don't know. One of these, maybe?
Why do you say that?
Because they're all alike.
Oh, but they're not. Look, see. Some are smaller, some are fatter. Some grow to the left, some to the right. Some even have lost some petals. All kinds of observable differences. You see, Harold, I feel that much of the world's sorrow comes from people who are this. Yet, allow themselves to be treated as that.
Well, I think it's fine building jumbo.
That what Harold and Maude had, even though he's 18 and she's 81, that they had love. They loved each other, and it was real. And it was genuine, and they had a connection. And I realized, love comes in so many different shapes and sizes and forms. And I was like, it doesn't matter. And it doesn't matter if I'm going to be in love with a man my whole life.
And, you know, Harold has, I don't know if you call it anger exactly, but one of the things he does when he's, that his dissatisfaction with life draws him to do is he keeps staging suicides, not real attempts, but he keeps depicting himself as dead, which is, I mean, it's sort of a, like a, an attack on himself or an attack on the world or attack on the life that he has. So, I mean, anger, I think, is something that is very closely adjacent to what Harold's doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And, like, it's like self-harm. Like, self-harm comes out of a place of, like, anger and sadness. Mm-hmm. And, like, and maybe I didn't self-harm, like, in the traditional sense, like, cutting myself or whatever. But I certainly did engage in self-destructive behavior for a long time when I was in the closet and just coming out of the closet. So, like, I get that sort of, that sort of expression that Harold was doing and acting out these sort of gruesome suicides. Like, that's something that also, like, that really resonated with me. That's how the movie opens up, right? Mm-hmm. It's, like, with him and one of those fake suicides. Like, it's a very strong, I don't know what you call it, motif or, you know, something that's used throughout the movie.
And it's such a different approach from The Conformist. Like, literally, the line of the song from Harold and Maude is, "You can do what you want."
Yeah, right, the Cat Stevens song.
Yeah.
And if you want to be me. And if you want to be you. 'Cause there's a million things to do. You know that there are. You can do what you want. The opportunities are. And if you find a new way, you can do it today. You can make it all true. And you can make it undo. You see.
And, like, because at the core of what was driving me, how I was able to sort of continue working in conservative politics, because I often hated it, was that I had this sort of, you know, I had a pretty sincere libertarian core belief system. And, you know, with that, which I still do largely, and with that is, like, this whole sort of, like, free spirit. I always felt that way. Like, that's what libertarian is to me, is, like, people should be able free to do what they want.
So tell me about the work that you started doing after. So you came to this congressional office, and where did you got back into politics, and where did that take you?
Yeah, and so I left. When I left to sort of concentrate more time doing the conservative organizing for the civil unions here. And we eventually got that passed. And then around that same time, I also started working on marijuana legalization here. In 2012, you know, voters approved Amendment 64 here in Colorado, which, of course, legalized marijuana. Mm-hmm. And I ran for the campaign. I ran all the conservative outreach. And so I spent the time driving across Colorado, speaking to all these conservative groups about why they should legalize marijuana.
And the argument, it's so funny that, like, pot legalization and marriage equality weirdly share a lot of that, like, you know, like you're saying, libertarianism of we should be able to, you know, it's my body, it's my life, it's my relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very conservative argument. But unfortunately, that argument, like, I got into fights all the time with people. By the time October rolled around, I was so exhausted of talking to Republicans that were 60 or 65 and older, which is also, you know, an interesting commentary on the system, too. I was talking to groups that were engaged about politics, and the only groups that engage about politics, particularly conservative politics, are old folks.
Right.
Young people are so disenfranchised, and, like, that the conservative movement, like Republican front, has got some serious issues because of how disconnected they are from young people. Mm. I mean, I think politics in general, even, like, Democrats have problems connecting with young people or challenges, but God, the Republicans are just screwed. Like, they don't connect with young people at all. Mm. Like, these are the two issues, I think, if you look, you know, what younger generation millennials care about. I think it's gay rights and, you know, drug legalization, marijuana legalization. They're always high on the list. And if you look at both of them, there's very solid conservative arguments for both. I mean, marriage, you should be a gay, people should be able to marry who they want. It's like getting the government out of people's bedroom. And, you know, even non-discrimination is equal protection under the law. I mean, there's nothing more conservative than that. But there's still zero, or very, very, very little Republican support for any of those.
Did you feel like an outsider again? Like, I've got this ideology and the people that I'm surrounding myself with I can't get them on board?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I definitely feel like an outsider. I mean, it's something I've come to accept, I guess, is that I'm going to be sort of an outsider position in what I'm working on now.
Well, now you're kind of in a reverse position where you're like, you're the Republican in a LGBT...
Right, but I'm still a little bit of an asset.
Yeah. So how did you...
Internally within the movement.
Yeah,
for sure.
How did you come to work at the Gill Foundation?
So I was continuing to do the marijuana stuff, and I had my own practice. I was doing my practice was the 3 G's, as I like to call it, ganja, gas, and the gays.
Okay.
And so I was still doing some gay work, and Gill Foundation contacted me to work on one of the amicus briefs for the 10th Circuit Court, gathering conservative signatures and corporate signatures on 2 different briefs.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that, and they liked it, and I liked them. And then after some talking, I thought this was a great opportunity to work at this, at an organization that would allow me a national reach to work on the national gay rights campaign. That's something I wanted to do. You know, working for the Republicans for all those years and
being a conformist over there, even though I was gay and I would push them internally, still, I felt guilty for a lot of the shit that we had to deal with on that side.
And the things, I was a press secretary when these senators had to made all these awful anti-gay comments, and it was just awful. A lot of that stuff. So I felt really guilty for the things that I did. And I carried that around, and I wanted to give back, to my community that was often maligned by the people I used to work for. And so, I'm at the end of the conformist, he doesn't give back. When fascism falls, he actually sells out all these other people to save his own ass at the end. And I was like, I watched it again just recently, and I was like, I don't want to be that. I was like, that's awful. I do want to get back. And he just sells people out and lives this torture. At the end, he's still living a tortured, awful life. Yeah, that's how it ends. Nothing's going to change. He's still going to be this terrible, shallow person. Bad person. I didn't want that. And so it took marijuana legalization to kind of get me there. That kind of opened my eyes about a lot of things, and I made a lot more friends, progressive activist friends, and this opportunity came along, and I talked to a lot of them about it, and I reevaluated what I really want to do with my life, and instead of just being sort of a
run-of-the-mill conformist political operative, I wanted to do something big and work on a big activist campaign, and so
that's here I am with the Gill Foundation. I'm doing that right now. It's super exciting.
Yeah. Did you feel like you're kind of, I don't know if this is the right way to put it, but making up for the lost time of being in the closet and then working for people who are kind of working against you?
Yeah, most definitely. I definitely was gravitated to working here at the Gill Foundation to connect with the gay community.
So how do you connect?
Hopefully I don't conform. Hopefully I maintain my identity still through that.
Sure. Yeah. You can certainly conform once you come out. Like, okay, these are the rules now.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
So back then, when you're still closeted, you describe yourself as that Abercrombie guy with, the very fratty, bro-y. What kind of gay man are you now?
I don't know. What kind of gay man do I look like to you, man?
I don't know. You're hard to judge because on one hand, to describe what I'm seeing right now, you've got a baseball cap with the straight brim, and I'm like that's a certain type of guy. But you've also got a wrist, a leather thing, a cuff on your wrist, and I'm like, oh, that's a little alternative, it's a little hipster. So I don't know. And you've got these glasses that are these plastic yellow glasses, and also you've got these thick black plastic lenses that look like, I don't know, you'd see it a shoegazer concert. So
I don't know. I think I like to nod to that. I think I like to think that I've come a long way from my bro-y past, but the reality is I probably have not.
Do you think of yourself, do you identify now, when you watch The Conformist, are you that was me, or I don't know who that person is?
No, I would say that I still identify. I think that was me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I still find myself trying to, on the path to conformity, you want, I think it's a very natural thing. People want to be accepted, want to be belonged, or want to belong somewhere. And so I think I still sometimes, and it's just if I gotta make the right choices, I guess I watch it now as a cautionary tale. Mm-hmm. I guess even though I'm much more self-aware and aware of who I am, I need to be careful about certain things, I guess.
It sounds like now Harold and Maude is more the way that you're the value that you've internalized.
Yeah.
It's interesting that it spoke to you. Harold and Maude was written by a gay man.
Yeah, that's right. Colin Quinn, right?
I think so. That sounds right. Yeah. So there's, you know, clearly something in there about, like, well, love can take many forms and, you know, that you don't have to follow the rules and meet these expectations and conform.
Yeah. And that's what I'm trying to do. That's why, I don't know, that's when you ask me what kind of gay man I am now, I'm trying to, like, not conform, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Not be any kind.
Yeah, not be any kind of gay man. Just be me. Trying to struggle, I guess. Always to be who you are. And find out who you are. I mean, life, I guess, is a whole path to self-discovery, I guess.
Well, Joe, thank you so much for joining me.
Ah, thank you, Matt. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks again to Joe for joining me and for the important work he's done to help guide Republicans to supporting equality for LGBTs. For my recommendation this week, I was at a bit of a loss. I wanted to find a gay movie, or at least a gay-adjacent movie, where a character learns to kick loose and have a good time. For some reason, the only one I could think of was Overboard with Kurt Russell and Goldie Hawn, so I asked my friends on Facebook and Twitter for their ideas. By the way, if you'd like to be in touch and suggest recommendations for future episodes, you can follow me at Matt Baume on Twitter or under the same name, Matt Baume, on Facebook. So, unfortunately, when I put this question to the internet, the very first suggestion I got was the movie Overboard with Kurt Russell and Goldie Hawn. But then dozens more came in, from Desperate Living to A Christmas Carol to MAME and Fried Green Tomatoes. I haven't seen Mrs. Pettigrew Lives a Day, but so many people suggested it that I think I probably need to. Same goes for Now Voyager. But it was friend of the show Alonzo Duralde from Linoleum Knife who nailed this week's recommendation, a wonderful and often overlooked film called You Can't Take It With You. The movie's based on a play by Moss Hart and George Kaufman, and as is so often the case, I do believe the book is better. But the movie's no slouch. It's the story of a quirky live-and-let-live family of weirdos who don't care about money and follow their dreams. When the story opens, the family's being pressured to sell their home so a millionaire can build a weapons factory in its place. Yeah, it's a little on the nose. Jimmy Stewart plays the son of the capitalist, and because this is the era of the screwball comedy, he falls in love with the company typist who just so happens to be a member of that household of crazy free spirits. I love the movie and the play for the snappy comedy, both physical and verbal, but the meaning of it is what sticks with me, and conveniently enough, it's encapsulated right there in the title. You can't take it with you. Like I said, a little on the nose. Money and power sure is nice, and for some people, it's all they need to be happy. And that's fine. In fact, it's a good thing, because if everyone was running around chasing their heart's desires, we'd be living in a hippie commune with no running water. We need big-picture power brokers to fight with each other over who can build the biggest, bestest infrastructure. But for other folks, money and power just isn't enough. For them, gathering resources is meaningless if you can't spread it around, give it away, share it, and improve the lives of other people. The key is for there to be a balance of those two types, the big-picture power brokers driven to build the world up, and the folks who are happiest when they have happiness to give away. Your job is to figure out which one of those is you. And if you realize you're in the wrong game, find a way to switch sides. Thanks again for listening, and please let me know your thoughts on today's show. You can reach me at Matt Baume on Twitter. And huge thanks to everyone who's supporting The Sewers of Paris on Patreon. Each episode takes about 10 hours to produce, and so if you're enjoying them, I hope you'll join the fabulous listeners who are keeping the podcast going for as little as a dollar an episode. Just visit sewersofparis.com and click Support the Show on Patreon. Or you can help the show out for free. If you like today's episode, just post a note about it on Facebook or Twitter. Tag me so we can say hi. You can also leave a review of the show on iTunes. Nickel CT recently wrote a review calling the show Education for the 21st Century Gay Man. Thanks, Nickel CT. Hopefully we can make it the next few decades and be education for the 22nd Century Gay Man. You can check out the show notes at sewersofparis.com for video clips of some of the stuff we talked about today, and get my book, Defining Marriage, featuring personal stories from the folks who fought for marriage equality over the last 40 years. It's now out in paperback and audiobook. There's also a companion podcast that goes along with the book, so if you like hearing me on this show, you might enjoy hearing me and my partner banter about marriage on that show. You can find all of that at definingmarriage.com. The theme song for the show is Parisian by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. And until next time, croissant.